Hi everyone, I've got a very special guest with me today. I've got Genoa all the way from Sydney, and I say all the way from Sydney, I'm actually in Sydney too, but I'm down the south coast. But yeah, it's so good to connect with Genoa, and today we're going to be talking about mindfulness and meditation. And why I'm so excited is because, as you guys can all see, Genoa is a male, and we're talking about well-being, meditation from a very experienced meditator and a mindfulness practitioner. So I think a good place for us to begin, Genoa, is to ask you how and why did you get into mindfulness and meditation? Because when I met you, you were in the liquor business. So it's very, very different.
Yeah, it's quite funny. Often people that knew me previously, because obviously I used to live in Adelaide, which is where I grew up, and they sort of knew me as who I was, and then they're like, oh, you teach meditation, and they can't get their head around it, because I was unlike anyone you'd ever considered to be a meditation teacher. So it took me 28 years to finally learn and be open to meditation, and up until that point, I'm skeptical, right? So I was very much, for me, I thought meditation was something along the lines of, you know, maybe I have to join a cult, do some kind of weird woo-woo hippie bullshit. And that wasn't of any interest to me, right? I wanted to be normal. I was interested in performance, but I hadn't made the connection between meditation and performance. So I was like, I can't control my mind. And so I never really gave it the chance. I sort of started hearing a little bit about meditation, but for me it was like, oh yeah, no, that weird stuff. And so it was only by luck that I ended up learning to meditate in a way. So what I mean by that is, as you mentioned, you know, I was working for an alcohol company. So, you know, I was a bar manager for a while. I studied uni. I did a master's in commerce and marketing. Then I spent time working in IT networking in corporate, and then I spent about 7 or 8 years as a sales manager for an alcohol company. And throughout that time, I experienced things that I thought were just normal to be a human being, right? So, you know, I didn't realize I actually experienced anxiety until afterwards. I just thought it was normal to feel really like sick in the stomach or nervous before certain things. And yeah, and when I was really busy at work, the only way to get to sleep, I'd put headphones in and put on a movie or some music so we'd cancel out what was going on in here. And for me, that was just normal. I was like, yeah, that's just what it is to be a human being, right? You just push through and you get up, and obviously I used alcohol a lot as a great number.
Yeah.
And I didn't see a problem with any of that. And that seemed to be the norm, because it is quite common. And also a lot of people don't tend to share that they are battling with things, you know, with overwhelm. And it's sort of a bit of a case of, most people I speak to, when they find out that someone else is like, oh yeah, they're experiencing that too, it's like, oh, I thought I was the only one. Amazing how we still sort of think that. And that's what I thought. So
yeah,
you know, that was just what it was. And you push through, right? You hustle and you're busy, and it's almost like a bit of a badge of honor that you are under the pump, and you push through and you partied hard, work hard, you know, which is, you know, still fine and fun, but it was becoming to the extent of, I would use it as probably a bit destructive.
Yeah.
And so having said that, I was still interested in performance, right? And so when I was working for the alcohol company, by chance, one of my clients, they owned a bar and a restaurant, but they were really creative and they still drank wine and ate meat and seemed normal, but they were operating at this higher level. And I was like, oh, wow, these guys are cool. And funny enough, actually had the restaurant was on the harbour here in Sydney. And so that was my first proper exposure to kind of people that I deemed as, you know, high performers and creatives that were meditating. And that sort of, for me, had a little trigger. I was like, oh, maybe there's more to meditation than what I, with my uneducated mind, thought. And so I started researching high performers. And I started noticing a common thread in a lot of high performers, and listening to podcasts, and one podcast in particular, a guy called Tim Ferriss is one of the OGs in podcasting. And he did this review once of some of the high performers for a book, and he found over 90% of them either used meditation or mindfulness in their routine. I was like, right. And that for me was like, okay, there's something in this. So I learned to meditate. And even at the time I learned it, and I didn't quite get it, and I was still thinking, and you know, I was like, okay, who knows what's going to go on here. And then I started shifting my how I engage with people. My awareness is one of the biggest things. Like anxiety aren't even a thing now. I just don't experience. If I ever get a little taste of it, I just feel it and move through it so quickly. And I deal with overwhelm so much better, and I'm just a lot more resilient. I barely get sick anymore. It's nuts how it shifted, and what was the catalyst then for me to move to become a teacher was the fact that I knew what it did to me, right? And it was pretty profound, the impact it had on me. And then I asked like my friends and family, you know, do you reckon I've changed much? And they're like, fuck yeah, you have.
Yeah. And
so I was like, wow, you know, it's not only just how I think I'm performing, but other people are noticing a change in me as well. And I was like, well, would any of my mates learn to meditate still? And most of them still wouldn't. And I looked at most of the teachers out there, and most of the teachers out there, they were still
struggling.
Well, they weren't. They have their people, their students, but what I noticed was that they weren't very
consistent,
relatable.
Oh, I see.
The teachers weren't still relatable. Like, it was lucky that I met the person that I did, and we became friends, and I liked them. But even she was, you know, probably to a lot of my mates, still a little bit sort of next step. Pretty cool. Like, she's like, I don't look at her where it was all, but, you know, next step level down, I was like, not many people are going to agree with that. And I was like, well, this technique, yes, it's you know, stems from Eastern philosophy. Now there's so much Western science supporting it, and Western science that's you can work in with it. And the technique itself is powerful without having to get too worried about the rest of it. Like, how about I just teach it and make it relatable and simple?
Yeah.
And I still drink, and I still have a good time, and I still muck around, and I still, as you know, I still swear, and you know, but my attachment to some of these things has shifted, and my ability to, you know, recover from these things and deal with you know, pretty full-on lifestyle has increased. So that's sort of and that's what I wanted to pass on without getting too caught up in all the.
So how often do you meditate now?
I meditate twice a day.
Twice. And is it morning, evening, or what's the?
So morning's my routine. Like, literally morning is just my set routine. So I meditate in the morning between 20 minutes to half an hour, depending how much time I've got.
Yeah.
You can drop down to 15 or 10, but I've got that set. Like, I don't, in the morning, I shower, I brush my teeth, I have breakfast. You've got time for all these things. I just add extra time for meditation. So if I've got to get up at 6, I know I get up at 5:30.
It's
a dead set. I'm fitting that 20 minutes, half an hour, regardless. And then the afternoon one is when I get creative, because the days are never the same, right?
Yes.
You can try and have a routine in the afternoon, which is ideal. The idea of it is that you kind of fit in anywhere. You don't need to have a meditation cushion and some bloody incense or whatever it is. Just you just better sit down. Doesn't matter if it's loud outside or it's moving or there's someone next to you, you're in a bus, that's irrelevant. So the second one is more like you get creative and you fit it in however you can, as long as you can sit down and close your eyes.
Okay. So how long did it take for you to get to that point of meditating consistently every day? Because I know, like, people like myself, I start it, then fall off the bandwagon, then get back on. Like, it's really hard to be consistent with your practice.
To be honest, I pretty much from the beginning, I was like, I'm doing it.
Okay.
And it wasn't cheap, so it was an investment for me as well. There was a solid value exchange, and I was like, well, I'm spending the time and money in this. I want to give it a crack and see if it works. And then I experienced the shift, and I was like, I don't want to go back to the old
self.
The old self. Because there's also different, the technique that I did is a lot more involved technique than just a little mindfulness app or whatever. So
yeah,
also that piece to it. And I just made it a priority. Like, one of the most common questions I get from people is like, how do you fit in? I'm too busy. I keep, you know, dropping off the wagon. I'm like, it's just going to be a priority.
Yeah.
If you'll fit in things, if it's a priority for you.
Okay. And I know there's different types of meditation out there. There's transcendental, there's guided, there's silent meditation. So when you refer to your practice and your training, what is it that you offer and what do you do?
So the technique that I specialize in comes under the bracket of a transcendent style of meditation. So do you want me to sort of touch on the other types and how it fits in as a holistic thing, or just talk about mine?
Yeah, it'd be good to have just an overview of what the different types are. Yeah.
So I'll break it down to sort of the three to four most common that are out there, right? So one is mindfulness.
Yeah.
A lot of people think mindfulness is meditation. So mindfulness itself is a state of present moment awareness, right? Yeah. And this is something you can do anytime, anywhere. You can be mindful while you're having your cup of coffee, you know, it's like actually drink it and taste it and smell it and look at it. You can be mindful when you're eating your food or when you're having a conversation with someone. Yeah. And the concept behind mindfulness is that this comes from a lot of the Buddhist philosophy, which is that as human beings, we are going to experience suffering. Right? The extent of which we suffer is kind of up to us. And that is dependent on the level of speculation we spend time in. So speculation of either the past, which is that, you know, the depressive what if sort of style story, or speculation of the future, which is all that anxiety piece, and attachment to things, like attachment to the way things should be, or to past things, or things that you want, or certain ideals, and a lot of the time and effort we spend on that. So that's where mindfulness comes into play, where if you can be mindful and just in the right here, right now, focusing on, you know, and just being engaged fully in whatever it is you are doing, there is no, or at least minimal suffering, right? And that's the concept around the mindfulness sort of piece. And you can literally do that sort of however you like. It's a great little tool to have to sort of strengthen the brain to move away from that consistent rumination. Now, there are then most meditation techniques as a byproduct will increase your level of awareness and ability to be more in the present moment. This is a natural byproduct, but there are also certain specific techniques. So meditation is actually a specific practice. Right? So some people say, oh, you know, I go for a run. That's my meditation.
Yeah.
So going for a run, it's not meditation. No, meditation is a specific mental practice. There's a lot of people, there's often a bit of gray areas where everyone's like, oh, you know.
Is it like white space meditation, just having, well, obviously thoughts come into your mind while meditating, but it's just accepting and surrendering those thoughts?
That is one type of meditation. Yeah. So one type of meditation that is quite common is the use of visualization. So you would sit there and create a mental picture, an idea, and from that you'll have a physical experience from whatever it is you are visualizing. So it might be you're visualizing, if you've heard of like a loving kindness, you're visualizing love and gratitude, and you will have a physical experience of that, right? And what that also does is obviously naturally the way our brains work is we look for familiar things, right? So if you are constantly you know, practicing or visualizing something, whether it is love or happiness or abundance or whatever it might be, you're more likely to pick up on that again. Just like if you're spending your whole time thinking of negative things, you're more likely to pick up on the negative things in the world. So you're sort of like shifting shifting your, what's the word for it? But you're shifting what you are sort of used to seeing, right? So if you're more used to seeing the positive or the love, you're gonna be able to pick up on it more.
Reframing?
Pardon?
Reframing?
Yeah, yeah, that's sort of what you're doing, right? It's literally our perception of what we see is different for everyone. Like you've got you and me might look at the same thing, and you see the positive in it, and I see the negative in it, right? And that's just depending on your framing of how you look out at the world. So that's what visualization can do. A lot of sports people use it before a big game or before, you know, they visualize how they're going to do it. So that becomes the easiest pathway to go because it's already been done before, right? Now, the other main, probably most common is that when they use concentration techniques, right? And this is basically use a single point of focus. So it might be like a flame or your breath or your nose or you know, part of the body potentially. And the idea is that by placing your concentration on one single point, you move out of the room. That's why a lot of people say, oh, you know, I am cooking or running or surfing is my meditation, because they have an experience of they're not sort of caught up in the chatter of the mind for a moment in time. They're just in what they're doing.
Mm.
Right. So the concentration techniques are designed to do this. And what often happens is when you are concentrating so hard, you almost, what they seem to experience, there's like little blips where you sort of drop and enter these deeper states of rest and expanded states of consciousness, which is well touched on with the non-directive style. You know, those sort of states of flow, and you're just in it and going and not caught up in this sort of thought. And so concentration is probably one of the more common ones out there. And then contemplation. So this is probably similar to what you were talking about before, where you literally place some awareness on the thoughts coming in and you'd be okay. You'd be like, okay, so sit here or whatever and allow the thoughts to come in, but actually place some awareness on them. So you can start increasing your awareness of how you operate. You go, oh, there I go. There's that thought that keeps coming back in. You know, whether you decompartmentalize it or label it or move away from it or whatever you do, you know, or might just say, this isn't serving me and move on. And so these contemplation techniques are designed to increase your awareness of some of the thoughts and processes going on, but not, you know, indulge and give them too much credence, right?
Yeah.
A lot of the guided apps that you see out there, they sort of use a blend of those three, a bit of visualization, maybe some focus and some guided work, and then maybe some contemplation on thoughts, then you sort of move back. Now then the last one, the one that I specialize in, of the most common techniques that are used out there, is the non-directive transcendent style of technique. And what I mean by non-directive is a lot of people get confused and call them concentration types of meditation because you're concentrating on the mantra.
Yes.
They're not designed to be, I suppose, focused, single-pointed focus like that.
Mm.
What I mean by this is the way these techniques work. So there's, like you've heard of TM, there's Vedic, you know, they're the sort of techniques that use this school of practical philosophy. The fundamental difference of these is that they use a mantra, right? Mm. And a mantra in this case is not an affirmation, like, you know, I am power or love, or there's no meaning.
It's a random word, isn't it? Because I got one when I was six.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember the word. I'll tell you, I was told not to tell anyone. The teacher said, oh, you can't tell?
You can tell a teacher. Like, you can.
You're not allowed to tell anyone. No, but then my father squeezed it out of me. He's like, so what was it? What was it? And I was like, only six or something. So I told him. But yeah, it's just a random word that you have no association with. And I guess the purpose of that is just to focus on the word and not have any connotations with the word.
That's meaning behind it. And that's partly why you keep it private. So these words aren't random. They're specific sound vibrations that are chosen depending on how old you are and your stage of life.
Interesting.
So, and then, because at a deeper level, you know, everything's energy and sound vibration.
Okay.
So they are designed to work at this level. And so the reason why you don't tell anyone is exactly what you said. You know, I might tell you that my word is XYZ. You're like, oh, that sounds like blah, blah. Or you might laugh at it or whatever. And so the next time I'm going to meditate, I've now got an attachment to you laughing at my word or you saying it sounds like this. You kind of lose the whole, you know what I mean? The whole power of it. Yeah, the purpose of it. And so it is these techniques, what they want to do is get you in this sort of state, almost a state of flow, right? So what these ones are about here is that we really simplistically, we spend most of our time either in wake, dream or sleep states, right? There's a few deeper levels to each. And what they found, and this is where the Eastern philosophy mixes with the West, is that sometimes in between, you know, when you're awake and sleep, as human beings, we're entering a different state of consciousness. And the ancients were talking about this field being the field of transcendent or the field of creativity or the field of pure consciousness or whatever it may be. And it was different to any other state we were in. And it was in the 60s or 70s they actually finally did some research on this state people were talking about. And so people would use this technique and they'd meditate and they'd measure, and it would be a different state of consciousness compared to the other three main states we sort of operate in. And what they found is that when you're in this state, your metabolic resting dropped sometimes between 2 to 5 times deeper than sleep in terms of your oxygen consumption and your heart rate and your body temperature. And when it happens, your body, because you know when you go to sleep at night, right? That's your body's time to rest and repair. You know, you accumulate stress and fatigue and whatever it is of the day, day in, day out, your body accumulates. You go to bed at night, your body rests and repairs and processes. Unfortunately, sort of, you know, we're at a state now where, you know, things like anxiety and insomnia and, you know, all that sort of stuff are becoming the norm is because the input seems to be outweighing our ability to process what we're experiencing. And so what this technique is designed to do is to give your body that extra level of rest and repair and processing to help work off the excess, I suppose, debt of stress that's in the system.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. And so, and the brain at the same time is also being stimulated in coherence. While if you were doing like a focused or, you know, listening to a guided app, there are different parts of the brain that light up. So it's really, really, and the reason I say non-directive is because the idea is that you literally flow between, it'd be like mantra, and then you'll have thought, and then you'll move back to the mantra, and then at some time you might even fall asleep if your body's tired, and then you sort of wake up and move back to mantra, and then you might transcend for a moment, and that means it's a thoughtless state, so you actually will be with no thought. And so that's where the idea of, you know, having no thoughts comes from, but it's not the only part of the practice. It's sort of what you want is to get that state of where you're not attached to the mantra, but you're also not attached to the thoughts. You sort of almost cruise.
That makes sense now.
Yeah.
After doing it. And I used to watch my mum and her head would go like this.
Yeah. That's when you sort of feel like you're trying. I do it all the time. I'm like, oh, like where? You know, you sort of, that's what it is. That's exactly what was going on. Because when you transcend, you're sort of going in. So that's what it is, which is why it's sometimes quite a different, it's a bit of a.
I would judge myself for it because I'd be like, oh, you didn't focus, or like. No. You're falling asleep, like you got to do it again, do it properly. But I would just go into that zone, and it's just, it's an amazing feeling because it's just a space of nothingness and it's so relaxing.
That's exactly it, right? And yeah. So it's designed to give you that experience, and give your body will do, you know, our bodies have amazing intelligence, right? We can heal ourselves, we can recover from things, but you know, the extent to which we can do that efficiently depends on other pressure our bodies are under, right? And so this sort of puts ourselves in a state where the body has the best chance, I suppose. If you're spending all day and you're busy and stressed and flat out and rah-rah and drinking and hover and this and that, and then you go to bed and you sleep maybe 6 hours and half the sleep's not that great, and you get up and you go again, your body's getting minimal time to sort of have its rest and repair. And what this is doing, it's creating a sort of a state and environment where your body can have that extra time to sort of do what it needs to do. And if it means it goes to sleep, it means you go to sleep, and that's okay. If it means you sit there and think a lot, it means your body's processing a lot. You know, if you disappear into thoughtlessness, it means you're transcending, and they're all just as valid parts of the practice.
Okay.
Does that all make any sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. It makes perfect sense. I've got a bit of relief hearing that, so that's good.
Well, that's the problem, because it's a bit of a more involved technique, and I still hear people even know quite a lot about meditation explain it as a concentration technique, and everyone, you know, and this is weird idea that you're meant to be able to control or clear your thoughts if you can't, you're not doing it properly. And so a lot of people are like, I can't clear my thoughts, I'm not doing it, which is a barrier, and meditation is a bit of a branding problem
still. Yeah. Okay, so you mentioned stress before. What is the relationship between meditation and stress?
Couple of things.
Yeah.
So one is, you know, naturally our bodies accumulate stress and experience, right? Part of this is due to, you know, our evolution to accumulate stress so we can prepare to survive the future, right? And this accumulation of stress, so that the way we used to, you know, the reason why we've evolved this way, which I'm, you know, this is obviously what you do, so you're all over this, is, you know, we'd accumulate stress and triggers to certain things. So moving forward, we'd be able to react to them quickly if they were deemed to be of any danger to our survival, right? With the whole, that would throw into gear our stress, fight or flight response, okay? Now, times have changed, and that response was there purely to help us survive. It's not about happiness or growth, you know, or expansion. It was literally about how do we survive the best, right? Now, however, our survival is based on different things. And for us now, the biggest, you know, fear factors for us are like not being liked or not finding a partner or not making enough money or not getting the job promotion or whatever it might be. And so now all these things are, we're getting conditioned to see these things as of potential danger or threat to us. So now these things are deemed as stressful to us. So we what happens here is now we're throwing into gear that same stress, fight or flight response, but it's almost going to become maladaptive, right?
Yeah.
And so what meditation does is stimulates the antidote, so it stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system, right? So what it does is almost it stimulates the antidote to that stress response. You know how you're sort of under the pump and you're, you know, you're a bit sweaty and you're nervous and, you know, you might get the nervous shits and, you know, you find it's hard to focus. I mean, sorry, hard to think creatively and expansively and, you know, whatever it may be. What this does is it stimulates the antidote to that.
Mm-hmm.
That's that rest and repair system. Now, what it's also doing is increasing our awareness. So when we talk about expansion of consciousness, it's not quite esoteric as it seems.
Mm.
You know, the only way you can change something is if you know it, right? If you don't, you only know what you know. And one of the biggest things that I've noticed is my awareness has shifted. So
what does that look like for you when you say your awareness has shifted? So
for example, what it looks like for me is I used to find certain things overwhelming and stressful, or someone would say something to me and I would want to get angry and fire back at them, or it would really eat me up. Mm. And I wouldn't pick up on the stimulus that would cause that. I just indulge in the response, right? I didn't have any awareness around what was causing me to feel that way or do that thing. I was just in it. Well, now I'm able to pick up on the fact that I'm feeling really, I'm like, because that person said X, Y, Z to me, right?
Yeah.
So what it's done is it's shifted my perception. So I see less things as stressful, right? So, you know, now I'm a lot more resilient in terms of, you know, things don't always go to plan, but it's like, it's okay. I will survive. And I'm a lot less reactive and I don't go into that, you know, fight or flight stress response, which again puts more pressure on the body in terms of releasing cortisol and adrenaline. If that's not used up, that again is an impact on the body, which we have to deal with. So for me, it's been able to pick up on certain things and triggers that used to really get to me, and now be like, there I go again, shift the direction. So, and what they've actually found is they've done research into sort of regular meditators, and what they've found is that the people that are regularly meditating, they're finding the gray matter around areas of, you know, introspection and moral reasoning and creativity are thickening, and the gray matter around like the amygdala and the fear response is actually shrinking. Becomes less of a, you know, driving factor in how we operate. And that's something that I've experienced practically.
Yeah. Cool. That's awesome.
Mm.
So in terms of stigma associated with men getting in touch with their, how would you describe it?
To be honest, it's more about being open-minded to allowing a better version of you to be put forward.
Yes.
So that's,
we can see that, but then there's a lot of judgment from others. And I think I shared the story about working with the prisoners and trying to get them to do yoga because I know how that could help them and their well-being, and they refused because they thought it was gay.
Yeah.
So there would be some misconceptions there as well relating to meditation. What misconceptions have you been confronted with, or have people challenged you on or asked you about, or what have you had to deal with?
So the main ones are around it being sort of, I don't want to become like an airy fairy woo woo hippie and lose my edge. One of the biggest ones, particularly with, you know, excuse me, you know, high performers, they're like, yeah, but my edge is my thing. I can't afford to be all airy fairy and like, yeah, whatever, man, nothing bothers me anymore, blah, blah. Right? Because that's sort of what it comes across as.
Yeah.
And the way I answer that is that imagine if you were able to have all your energy spent on the things that are important to you and not the energy spent on all the worry and the other shit going on in your mind. If anything, it'll sharpen your ability to focus and give energy to the things that are of value to you. You know, there'll be less, there's less indecision, less back and forward, less time spent in speculation. So you'll actually also find that your productivity will increase because you'll make sharper, quicker decisions. And a pretty common thread between, you know, people who practice this regularly is an increased level of creativity as well. So in that way, you will be less affected by things and less driven to react to stimulus or situations or people, and then have a more holistic, creative, balanced response to that same situation, as opposed to being like, rah, fiery, blah, you know, this and that. You might have a more constructive response to these things and be able to spend your energy on things that are important.
Yeah. And I think that's what's so amazing about meditation. It really increases your self-awareness. Because as you said, I mean, you can't change what you don't know, but if it develops your self-awareness and you have those aha moments and go, oh, okay, this is what it's triggered in me.
Yeah.
And then you've got a choice because you're aware and you can go, well, maybe if I respond in this way, I won't get triggered. And how does that feel? And you're probably going to get less angry, less anxious. And yeah, it really helps with self-regulating your emotions. And what I hope is that it also facilitates conversations, whether it's men talking to other men, their mates, or other females. But it's really, I think, grounding us as human beings to be more connected with self, because we're so distracted by social media and other things that are removing ourselves from who we are and the essence of who we are.
We're becoming so externally motivated and unconnected, disconnected, We feel like you've got your social media and all the rest, but we are tribe creatures, and the difference between, you know, having lots of friends and all the sort of other stuff and bits and pieces to having like real connection with other people and real connection, understanding of yourself is huge. And I think that's going to be something that's going to come out a lot more now in terms of awareness of how important that, that piece is, you know.
So in your community, let's say your tribe, do you find that more of your mates are moving in that direction, and are you having more conversations about feelings? And as you said before, you didn't know what it was that was going on for you, and now you can go, ah, okay, that's actually anxiety. Are you finding that?
Yeah. Like, I haven't become any, not I've turned into a, you know, a pussy or whatever. Like, that was, remember, I'd, you know, get comments like that. And now guys are seeing that, oh, it's actually increasing his performance, you know. And we'll talk about things. And one of the biggest problems we have as guys is there is a stereotype that we have to have our shit together and push through, and with the provider, and we, you know, with this and with that. And that's a, I would say, destructive stereotype we feel we have to fit into as guys. And that I'm just now, you know, chatting about things, you know, I was like, I was battling this weekend, you know, I didn't have my shit together, or, you know, whatever it might be. Most other 98% of other guys that I know were like, yeah, I was struggling with this too, or blah blah, and I was like, oh, we've all got something going on that we're not okay with. And it's a whole different story when it's not seen as a weakness. True, the way I look at it as true strength is about to own your shit. And, you know, and then go, oh, okay, this is something that's not working for me, and then work on it, as opposed to going, no, I'm fine, not trying this weird thing, and I'm, you know, not open-minded about that.
Yeah. I'm also curious to know, what are some of the thoughts that men would have associated, say, for example, anxiety? Because I know that I had a friend who was clearly depressed. And he labeled it as, oh, I'm definitely not depressed, I'm just unhappy. I'm like, well, you get out of bed at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you're not exercising, you're showing all the signs of depression, but they didn't want to have that label attached to them. So as females, I think we're more inclined to have an understanding of what anxious thoughts are and where we feel it in the body. But for men who, I think in schools, this is something we should be talking about, but it's only coming up now where we're having conversations. So there's a bit of a delay there. So if you could help us understand from a man's perspective in terms of those anxious thoughts, what's going on? What does that look like?
So for me, the thoughts around anxiety were, there was actually, to be quite specific, there were situations that I would have. So let's say I would get really anxious before a big game of sport, right? Mm-hmm. What would happen is I'll start thinking about the sport and I'll start thinking, worrying about all the scenarios that could go wrong in the sport. And then I'd start feeling tight in the chest. I actually would feel physically ill, like I'd want to vomit. And then I would start thinking, okay, how can I get out of this? You know, will something happen that it'll stop this event from going forward, or can something happen for it to end? And I'd almost want to like run away and hide from it happening.
Yeah.
It was crippling. I couldn't concentrate on other things. And in the end, I mean, obviously before sport, it wasn't easy to, numb it with booze, but that was probably the only time that I'd get nervous back then in my early 20s, late teens, early 20s. I would get nervous before a date, for example.
Yeah.
Right? And so I would booze to numb that, right?
Wow, that's so interesting.
Yeah. Because I was like, I'd just drink through it so I would have the confidence and whatever it might be. And so I found myself trying to use other things and I'd push it away. And what I learned is that if you're feeling, the worst thing we can do is suppress. It gives it more power. It's going to come back another day, right?
Yeah.
What I've learned is that if you are feeling any kind of like, you know, the tightness in the chest, or you're feeling sick in the stomach, you're like, oh, I'm not good enough, I can't do this, or what if this happens, or blah, blah, not to try to push it away, but to actually feel it and let it move through the body so we can actually be processed and move out of the body. Because that's one of the things we're taught as males, is like, you got to just push through it and feel it, feeling it. And also because feeling it doesn't feel good. So we'll push through it. I want to feel that feeling, but we're actually almost like storing it and giving it more power by pushing through, and then it'll come back later on and bite us in the ass again harder.
In terms of feeling it, you know what came up for me, because I know this is what we told the inmates, is that when you feel anxious or you feel a particular feeling, it's so important to label it or identify it. So say I was on a date and I was feeling, so let's pretend I'm a bloke, right? I'm on a date with a hot, hot girl, and I'm feeling extremely anxious. And then I'm like, my palms are sweating, and then, I can notice knots in my stomach. And if I said, look, I think you're extremely attractive, I'm actually feeling a bit nervous. Like, and that's the power of vulnerability and owning that. And I think that also commands respect, because she will be able to identify with it, but also respect that you had the courage to name it. But it's also a compliment. It's like, it's flattery as well to say, well, you know, you're really gorgeous and this is the effect you're having on me, instead of like been drinking or
literally if you've got the balls to say that you were a bit nervous or worried, that's big. My girls will pick up on stuff, you know, and if you've, they'll go, oh, he's confident enough to say he was a little bit nervous. And I was reading the other day this amazing book. They touched on anxiety and that kind of feeling. And the best you can do is almost like supercharge it and convert it into some kind of a positive action. Be like, oh, I'm feeling it because I'm excited. Fuck, it means I'm living. And that I'll now flip it into that. I don't really have it anymore. I haven't had it for years at all. But remember when I would get a taste of it, that's what I would do. I would actually flip it into more of a it means I'm doing something out of my comfort zone, and it means I'm challenging myself.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah. And that's how I'd like, you know, do that and feel it, as opposed to like, right, come on, push it down. All right, have a couple of beers, you know, and that kind of a thing, and just battle my way through it with, you know, below average chat.
Yeah, absolutely. Very powerful. Okay. So in terms of your service offering, if someone wants to connect with you and get there, do you also give out the words, the mantra?
Yeah. So I do, there are two, I teach the full, the Vedic technique is what I specialize in, which is done in person. And I'll give you the mantra. I'll take you through, it's like 3 2-hour workshops, and I'll take you through that full course. And the idea is that you walk away as a self-sufficient meditator. So you don't need to be guided by me or plug into an app or whatever it can be. Mm. And so I offer that, but I also offer an online version of the course, which isn't the full course, but it's a slightly tweaked version where I teach a little bit of mindfulness, some breathing techniques and a meditation technique and some philosophy around that. So there's sort of two ways I do it.
Awesome. And then people can reach you through?
Instagram's probably the biggest, the most active. Instagram.
You do Insta stories and you're quite active on Instagram. You're quite active. You do Instagram stories.
I do stories, little videos. I do little posts on sharing things that I've experienced and a bit of vulnerable stuff. And then obviously website, there's a few articles on as well, because I'm very much into the science. So my website's got lots of little links and stories that are a bit more scientific as well.
So, that's genoa.com, right? Or .com.au.
Yeah, so it's the website is genoa.com.au and name is Genoa Van Keekman.
Perfect.
Easy to spell, right?
Yeah, very easy. You might have to spell that out, actually. I know how to spell your first name, but you might have to spell it out.
My name is Genoa Van Keekman. So it's Instagram. It's at JANOAH, then VANKEKEM, Van Keekman.
Perfect. And I'm following you on Instagram too, so if people get confused, they can check out who I'm following and just search your name there, and then they'll be able to find you. Thank you so much for your time, Genoa. That was really rich and insightful.
I'm glad. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Thank you. Okay.